Thanks for coming to today's Spotlight with Catherine Collins. Happy to have her here today. Catherine produced the comic Wheel of Horse under the name Arn Zaba.
Zaba. Yes, that was my name when I thought I was a boy. And I discovered my mistake at some point. Changed it. This is what I've been calling the Neil the Horse phone book, because it's so huge. I had no idea it was going to be this big, but Andy sent me a copy, to, you know, my first look at it. I just immediately started putting it down on surfaces, walking away and looking at it from a distance, because I thought, that's my big book. So I should weigh it, I guess.
So just to give some background, Neil started as a comic strip in 1975. It was syndicated in Canadian weekly newspapers.
Right.
In 1982, Neil and his friends Soapy and Mamzelle Poupée began starring in their own comic, which ran for 15 issues. Neil the Horse comics and stories is often referred to as the world's first and last singing and dancing comic book.
Yeah, that's my line.
Often referred to by Catherine and other people.
Let me explain that not every story, but most stories, the characters would stop and sing a song, just like in, you know, in a musical comedy. And then the songs that I've written, and we print the sheet music in the back of the comic book. So the slogan for the comic book was "Making the World Safe for Musical Comedy." So there.
It's a very interesting format that it was marked a British children's annual. It contained old reprints of the newspaper strip, contained cutout paper dolls, passions for Poupée, contained a letters page written in character, and as Catherine mentioned, it contained sheet music for a lot of the original songs that she wrote to go with new stories.
And there were also quite a few text stories with the characters, with the illustrations. So, I left no format untouched.
So the comic ended in 1988, and after a proposed stage show, graphic novel, and animated cartoon didn't get off the ground, Neil and Arn as well both went away as Arn transitioned into Catherine Collins we have before us today. And as Catherine mentioned, this weekend, Conundrum Press is releasing the collected Neil the Horse, first time the character has been in print in almost 30 years.
That's right, amazing.
And tonight Catherine will be inducted into the Doug Wright Awards Giants of the North Canadian Cartoons Hall of Fame. So please welcome Catherine Collins.
Thank you.
So for those who don't know, Neil the Horse, the comic, focused on three characters mostly. There's Neil the Horse, who's kind of a spindly-legged doofus character who
loves bananas.
Kind of set with an obsession for bananas. There was Soapy, the kind of cynical,
back alley,
world-wise back alley cigar-smoking cat, and Mamzelle Poupée, sort of very sexy, large-breasted wooden doll who was looking for love and Broadway fame. That's kind of an odd combination for a comic. Can you tell us a bit about why those characters?
Why those three characters?
And how you developed them?
Well, what I didn't do was sit down and, decide, I'm going to create a character that does this. What was happening to me, this is back in 1974, I guess it was, that I knew I wanted to find the right characters to create it so I could do stories of unlimited scope, meaning so the characters could go anywhere, do anything. The way, my model for that was the Disney characters in Carl Barks' Donald Duck, and to some extent, Mickey Mouse by Floyd Gottfredson, which I just discovered at that point. So they had to have a sort of plausible reason, plausible within the cartoon world, plausible reason to go places and do things. So. I tried a number of different character concepts and drew some pages of comics, and I wasn't satisfied. And then one day, I was walking home from work. I was in Deep Cove, North Vancouver, and I was just within sight of my little cottage, and suddenly it just struck me. You know, I'd been thinking and planning and logicing it out, and suddenly, it just came, and I always see it as a big thought balloon over my head. And what I saw in that thought balloon was Neil, the horse, and Soapy, the cat. Poupée was not there yet. But their appearance, the way they acted, the way they act, their relationship with each other and so forth. It's just all there in a split second. So I guess you have to call that inspiration. So anyway, so I started doing stories with them, syndicating it, self-syndicating small-town weekly newspapers. And then after about a year and a half of doing that, I decided to move out to Toronto from Vancouver. And so then when I got here, I quickly realized that trying to do newspaper strips was a losing proposition, because the newspaper strip is a dying art. It's very difficult to get anybody very interested. But I persevered on weekly strips for, I think it was at least 3 years. I'm sure I can remember. But Poupée still did not exist until in the strips, she suddenly appeared. And I guess the very first time that she appeared, she was just a one-off character. And Neil saw this a doll. She was Poupée as a doll. Neil saw her crying with a broken heart, and he collected all the broken hearts that were in the air and lying around, and scotch taped them all back together. And a horse doing scotch taping, something to see. And then he gave the mended hearts back to her again, hoping that would help. So she just kept coming in as a device to expand the range of what the characters would talk about. Neither Neil nor Sophie would be searching for love. Neil's too young and stupid, and Sophie's been around and done it all already. So it was handy for me to have a character who could talk about that type of issue. And as I went along further, she just kept coming back, and I couldn't make her go away. So then I realized she was also handy, because neither Neil nor Sophie have hands. So it's very hard for the characters to pick something up and look at it, or do something, write something down. So it was handy to have another character who could do things like that. So that was one of the reasons that I put her in, is because she has hands. So anyway, but by the time I've started doing comic book stories, mostly because people asked me to, she was a permanent member of the trio, and so she remains to this day. So there, okay.
So as you mentioned earlier, music was a big part of the comic. Aside from the sheet music, dancing was a big part of the comic. There would be pages and pages of characters just dancing. You did a five-part musical radio play for CBC based on Neil and his friends. You did an audio cassette tape of songs, all written by you. Why did you incorporate song and dance in the comic?
Why did I do that?
Why, and how do you think it changed the way you might have done comics otherwise?
I don't know. Well, I don't know in a sense. But looking back, I can see that, you know, I was drawing and writing from a very early age, before I was 10. And I was always putting songs in. The characters would stop and sing. And I did a picture book, you know, text and pictures book, and that same thing happened. And then I was doing a comic strip in my university newspaper, UBC, and the characters finally insisted on singing. So it just seemed to be something I couldn't do without. And partly it was a way for me to show off my songs, even though sheet music is a pretty mute medium. But nonetheless, it's better than a poke in the eye. And then it just became a, without my meaning to, it became sort of a signature or hallmark of my work. And people began really reacting positively. So that was fine with me. I loved doing it. And I just never looked back.
And you had no training as a songwriter, right?
I have no training as anything. I've never taken any lessons in anything. I'm totally self-taught. And I never do anything written or drawn or anything if I don't already know it's going to be used. And then I just sit down and do it. No training, no preparation, no sketch. I don't you know, sort of plan things out in advance. I just make it all up and say, oh.
And music's very important to you personally, though. Why is that?
well, I know most people hate music, but just why is it? Why do I like music? Well, why wouldn't I like music?
Fair enough.
My parents were fans of the swing bands of the 30s because that was their era of being young, and so I heard, you know, millions of hours of swing jazz and Broadway shows and so on. So I just absorbed all that through my skin, and to this day, swing is my favorite form of music. So I just had to participate. I'm not going to let swing music in general exist without participating. I want in.
You danced for a few years, like you told me, right?
Well, sort of.
Yeah. You took dance.
I took dance classes here in Toronto. I think I'm in Toronto. It's hard to know sometimes. It was in the 80s when I was already in my 30s. I can't remember exactly how old I was when I started, but I had no illusions I was going to perform. But it was a professional dance school here for young people who were aspiring to be jazz dancers, doing jazz dances, which is sort of almost the same thing as Broadway show dance. So I took the first year level dance classes every year for 8 years, and the school just let me keep coming. And even if I wanted to become professional or even graduate in the second year level, I couldn't have done it. So I can't claim that I was a good dancer at all, but I just enjoyed it so much. And it taught me a lot about dance, so that when I started to draw dancers in my stories and choreography, then I had an idea of what they were doing, you know, if they twisted it a certain way or kicked their legs in a certain way. I knew how it felt. I knew what it was about. That really helped me when I was drawing the dancing. And when I drew the dancing, it was real choreography that I drew out. I didn't just draw people kicking and flailing like so many films, animated and live action. Nobody's really dancing. You just see snippets of people flailing their limbs around. It really helped me. And I discovered that one of the wonderful things about dance, doing dance, is that it's an equally 50-50 blend of your mind thinking about what you're doing and your body having to do it. And of course, then you start to get muscle memory. And when your brain says, oh, do this certain thing, your body starts to know how to do it. And I love that combination. You could stop thinking, but you were using, you know, your body in a very, very, very energetic way. So when I moved away from Toronto in 1989, I tried to find, I went to London first, London, UK, and I tried to find some dance school that would let me do the same thing, but I couldn't find one. So then I started doing aerobics, which was the next best thing. At least I was still moving in the same ways. So yeah, I guess I should go back and say that in about 1979 or 1980, I rather belatedly discovered Fred Astaire. I'd never watched him before. So there I was in my early 30s, I guess. And I just went completely bonkers for Fred.
All
proceeds fell in love.
Toronto Public Library Foundation. The store is open on Tuesday, Friday, and Saturday.
It's a worst sponsor.
And oh.
So, located on the first floor next to the ED Gallery.
So I just was completely bowled over by Fred, and I began to understand dance in a much more detailed way. And that's what prompted me to take the classes. So dance suddenly became really important to me, important to my life. And I did do the radio musical comedy for CBC. I wrote it and produced it and edited it and acted it as Neil.
Yo, I'm Neil the Horse, hello.
And then it was just inevitable to seep into the comics.
And you did a two-part Fred Astaire tribute story in Neil the Horse, and you just talked about how you leaned on your own experience dancing to draw choreography, but the way you drew it in that issue was is an especially interesting story.
Oh, well, yes. There's only one story where I actually drew Fred Astaire dancing with Mademoiselle Poupée. By that time, I was deeply into studying my boy Fred, and I had this funny little device called a thermal, colloquially known as a thermal printer, which you would heat up, you would hook up to a television set or whatever. And I hook it up to a VHS tape player. That's what we had back then. And I went through all of Fred's dances, I don't know, maybe not all of them, but a whole bunch of them. I just printed one still image after another, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And then I sort of pasted them up on large sheets so that I could see them as a sequence. And what I was doing that for was to study his movements, to see how it looked when he did such and such, and also what movements did he favor. Because what I was working on was to create my own choreography, but for Fred Astaire, with his kind of movement, and dancing with Poupée. So the Fred Astaire dancing and the other dancing in here is all very authentic choreography and dancing moves. But it was the only way I was ever going to get to choreograph for Fred. So, that's what I did.
So, along with being a cartoonist, you worked for several years with CBC Radio doing.
I did it for about.
Talks about comics on Morningside. You did a 5-part documentary on the history of comics, where you look back on some of the great cartoons that you had loved as a child.
Well, actually, it was a slightly different thing. The 5-part documentary, so called. It was on the Ideas series. Mm-hmm. And what I was doing, I was investigating at that point was the intractable. Low esteem which our societies have, held comics. You know, they were just regarded as garbage, no matter who did, no matter what they did. So I set out to answer the question, if I could, is there something inherently garbagey about comics? Is there something inherently limiting that makes it impossible to do serious work? Not necessarily sober-faced work, but you know, serious. I went around the United States and Canada, interviewing all of my favorite great old cartoonists who luckily were still alive at that time. I interviewed Norman Conniff and Harold Foster and Floyd Gottfredson and one of my favorites, Russ Manning, and a bunch of others. And that became part of the series. And then I wrote the questions that I had in my own mind and my own answers. But then I would drop in these clips of the great cartoonists speculating on my question.
So as you said, you felt that a lot of those cartoonists were great art. Why did they influence you so much, and how did they affect your own work?
Old-time cartoonists.
The older newspaper cartoons.
Yeah. Well, to this day, my favorite comics in the world, besides Carl Barks, apart from Carl Barks, are the old newspaper strips starting from the day that newspaper strips were invented in 1897 with the Cats and Jammer Kids. They're still around. And up through the late 90s into the early 20th century, and I guess up to about 1925, I just almost uncritically loved all of the comic strips from that period, and then even then, the syndicates and the newspapers started to interfere, started to shrink the strips and treat them just as a commodity, and giving the cartoonists less and less leeway. To make the pictures look like what they wanted, and contain the content they wanted. But I still love the strip right up to about 1960. And I've got this enormous collection, not only of clipped out Sunday strips, Sunday pages from the early years, but also every book I can lay my hands on, which these days is a lot, book of reprints of old strips. So I'm not sure what the question was now.
Why did you admire these artists so much, and how did they influence your work?
Well, they influenced my work, it was backwards, just by reading all of them and wanting to be as loose-limbed and sort of crazy as many of them were, which was wonderful. So it was that art form, the newspaper strip, especially the big Sunday pages. It made me think, oh, that's the size that comics ought to be. Never mind this little size. That's one reason why this book is slightly big in measurement, because I drew the comics for the comic books, which were like tiny little paper napkins, and I always thought if I ever got a reprint that we would reprint it bigger. Well, as Andy knows, I don't know if he's still here, but Andy's the publisher for Penguin Press. Yeah, so as Andy knows, I kept trying to get the book even bigger. I wanted it 9x12 or 11x17 or I don't know what, you know, something huge. And I still intend, if I get to do any more comics, I still intend to do some great big pages. So it's just the aesthetics of those old strips. And so I guess that's how they influenced me. Also, they were very permissive. They were allowed to do anything, you know, lots of cartoon violence and socially undesirable behavior, and a lot of drinking and smoking and carrying on. So that seemed to me that, well, that's better than High and Lois or something like that, you know, which is like a nice little suburban couple. I've always been an admirer of and practitioner of behavior outside the bounds of the law and social norms. I'll do anything I feel like, no matter what it is, no matter what anybody says. So I look for laws to break. And the characters were in the early strips were so raffish, you know, and getting in all kinds of trouble with the law, but eventually prevailing, which is my model for how to behave in life. So anyway, I sort of answered it.
Yes. So Neil started as a newspaper strip, but it really gelled as a comic, as we talked about earlier. So there was a compendium of so many different things, you know, old strips, text pieces, new pieces, sheet music. How did you settle on that format, and can you tell us a bit about the process of putting one of those issues together?
Well, I would say I didn't settle on that format. I failed to settle on the format. I just always, when I thought of a story, I saw it in a certain way. If it was a text story or a comic story, and even then, if it was a text story, then is there a lot of text on each page or a little bit? And how big were the pictures on the page? So forth. But it always came to me like that. You know, like the story, Neil the Horse in Old New France, which is old French Canada. As soon as I thought of the story, I knew that it had to be fairly heavy with text and then with the illustrations. So I just followed the dictates of my imagination. Because I think that the best way to be an artist in any medium is just do what you feel like, do what you see, do what's there in front of you that you want to do, and never mind what anybody thinks. And so it never occurred to me that I wouldn't put stuff of any description into the comic. So when it came to do it issue by issue, most of the time there was a fairly heavy component of older work that I had done that had never been seen or almost never been published in very small places. So I had a lot to draw on, because I'm a very slow cartoonist. I'm the world's slowest, actually. So I would do as many new pages as I could for an issue. But I was really, really glad I had old work that I could put in as well. And that meant that everything that I'd done that I thought was important eventually was published. So I love those old children's animals. I grew up with Rupert the Bear. And they had really eccentric stuff. The guy, Alfred Bestall, who drew Rupert, he was a very active member of the British Origami Society. So there were all these little origami projects in the Barry books. And he had coloring pages and games and different kinds of things. So my influences were not just comic books, not North American comic books, and certainly not superheroes. I have nothing good to say about superheroes. End of talking.
So what was the process like in putting together an issue for you?
Well, it's like I said, I would try to do as many new pages as I could. But I would see, I could see ahead of time how far I could go, how many I could do. So then I would rummage through the archives and say, I always wanted to reprint this or that. So I just kind of added up, it's like pouring water into a bucket, eventually it's full. But I didn't, I never tried to meet the deadlines. My poor publisher, Danny, she never knew when an issue was going to come. And it came when I was good and ready. And I don't believe in deadlines. I believe in doing the work, making it the way it should look. And so what it meant was, for the course of those 15 issues, really that I'm working all the time. I was just finish an issue and immediately start on the next issue. So that was great. I mean, it was just so exhilarating to have somebody publishing. So I can't say any more than that about the process of putting an issue together.
So you started your transition to sort of the end of the first phase of your career, and you think you've been spending some more time around the comics industry recently. Have there been any challenges that you faced as a trans woman in the industry? And do you see any change between then and now?
Well, that's a big subject. Okay, everybody settle down now. We're going to be here a long time. Well, let me see. When my cartoon work stopped in 1993, it was because nobody would publish me. Nobody would even answer my phone calls. Nobody would even think about dealing with me. This is just after 2 months. It started just 2 months after I made it public that I was going to transition. I went for the last time to the San Diego convention and arrived there as cancer. But it got a lot of negative reaction, especially from the guys, the superhero guys especially. They thought it was best for all concerned to take it upon themselves to be rude and nasty to me. But in general, that's what you expect when you're a transsexual. You have to know that you're going to get unbelievably negative reactions from a whole lot of people. Two members of my family just cut me right off. And I lost quite a few friends who just, I never saw them or heard from them ever again. And in society in general, especially back then, the early 90s, society had no room for a transsexual. I didn't feel any need to adjust. And even the New York Times had I read an article in it where somebody, it wasn't about trans issues at all, somebody was talking about whatever it was and used the expression as crazy as a transsexual. So I wrote to the New York Times and they printed my letter saying, I'm sorry, but you can't say that anymore. We transsexuals are people who are just trying to be ourselves and trying to have whatever, the idea of a normal life. I said we just want to be citizens and not anybody else. So that shows where society was at when the New York Times could casually print in a sentence that said as crazy as a transsexual. But obviously it's changed a whole lot for people, trans people in the last 25 years. It's never going to be perfect, probably, especially in the States, as you probably have noticed. There's a lot of negativity towards transsexuals, and trans women, such as myself, regularly get murdered in the States, usually about two a month. And it's always the same. If somebody finds the body and it's been assaulted grievously. So I'm encouraged that it's coming out at all, things are improving. But anytime something like that improves, there's also a very negative reaction. So I don't know, in terms of my own work, whether it was because of my transition that I couldn't get published anymore. It's pretty remarkable. I went from being friends with all sorts of people, lots of publishers and others, to being completely incommunicado, like nobody wanted to even, you know, speak to me. So, was it because of my transition? I don't know, because I found out later that that apparently was a very bad time for the comics industry in general. Apparently there was a lot of retrenchment, a lot of smaller companies going out of business, a lot of even the big companies, the superhero companies, were having to cut how many issues they published and that sort of thing. So, was it that, or was it that my work was just so uncommercial? I mean, singing and dancing animals or sheet music is not exactly what the public was looking for. And I, you know, never fooled myself about that. So, or was it transphobia? I don't know. But for 25 years, I was out in the cold. I just had no career. And so I reacted in such a way as to try to avoid as much pain as possible. So I stopped even thinking about cartoons. Put all my collection in a storage locker, and I dismantled my art studio, and just went on to do other things. Excuse me. I was lucky. I had just met this woman who became my, as I say, my lesbian husband, and she, you know, so that took up a lot of my time and attention. It made life gratifying in a different way. Unfortunately, then she died of cancer, which also took all my money. And I'm completely broke. And I've never had a partner since, because, as I've discovered, most lesbians of my age absolutely won't even be in the same room as a transsexual. So, I'm lonely. But at least, yeah, in 2013, I suddenly started getting these emails. I don't even remember who wrote them now. But somebody back east here in Toronto wanted something, wanted me to contact them. But I was so used to hiding from the comics world that I wouldn't answer the emails. I didn't know what it was about. It. I thought it was probably going to be bad news. So I just didn't want to answer. So finally, somebody who I knew, who also knew these people, sent me an email. Robin McConnell sent me an email saying, "For God's sake, answer the emails. They're trying to give you an award." and my first reaction was, "I don't want an award. I don't want to have anything to do with comics." So I was going to write back an email that said, "Fuck off." Then somebody else, I don't remember who, begged me not to do that. So I finally communicated with them, and it was not the award giving body giving me an award this evening, but the other Hall of Fame in Canada, the other Comics Hall of Fame. Canada has so many famous cartoons, and we need two different competing Halls of Fame.
It's called the other Hall of Fame.
It's the Joe Shuster Awards. So by the time I finally decided I should communicate with them, and we, you know, found out they were giving me an award, and I was really grateful, and I changed my whole attitude. But by that time, it was too late for me to come out to Toronto. And I was in the middle of a period of really bad health, too. So I sent them a video, which I made at home, my thank you speech. And I'm very grateful to those people, and I'm going to thank them again tonight at the awards ceremony. So that was wonderful. And then a number of people, including Conan, who has his own magazine, people started offering to publish me. Well, I wasn't ready for that, because I haven't drawn a picture since 1993 or something. So it took me a long time to even begin to get ready to do it. And also, I was going through my worst period of ill health at that time. I spent almost the entirety of 2015 sick in bed with a high fever that never went away. It began to become apparent that these people in Eastern Canada, mostly the Toronto area, remembered me and seen my work and liked it, and that they, you know, they wanted to continue to sort of encourage me to be a cartoonist again. At that point, I was working as a social worker for people with mental disabilities, which I really enjoyed. But anyway, yeah, so I started getting these offers, but I was too sick at the time to do anything about it. And then Andy Brown of Conundrum Press, was the publisher, my phone book, he said he would like to publish this, you know, collection of all my old work. And he's also said since then he'd be happy to publish anything else I ever do. So I'm sending him all my grocery lists.
What do you want to do next? What would you like to do?
Well, I had a well, at that time I referred to it as a graphic novel, but that's too short to be a graphic novel. But I have this unfinished project. It was almost entirely penciled by the time I just gave up. And, you know, that was the project I was trying to peddle, and when nobody would talk to me. So I've got this, well, this graphic novel. It's a short graphic novel. He said, yeah, I'm going to add about 10 more pages. But I'm going to exhume it and finish it up. And so that will be my next project. I have no idea how long it will take, because I have to get my drawing chops back. But since most of it is penciled, it's going to be mostly a matter of going over it. But what it would have been ink, now it's on the digital tablet, the Wacom's antique tablet. It's got a lot of stages. You draw on the screen, and there's, you know, your picture appears beneath your stylus. So I think by doing that, by basically tracing over my old work, the old pencil work, I will remember how to draw it. And then, after that, after I get my Nobel Prize for comics, which is my next award, then I'm going to do new stories. I don't know what format exactly. I do want to have a website, and I might start putting some work on the website, and then that could eventually go to print as well. But I'm not sure. I do want to work in color, enough black and white.
I'm sure we look forward to all of that.
Let's hope I can do it.
We have time for some questions, if anybody wants to ask anything. Right here.
I thought I read in print recently about the possibility of a biography.
I don't know. No, I don't think so.
So I didn't read that, and there's no thought of you authoring your life story?
I don't think so. Certainly, I've never heard about that.
Conan should do it.
He should write an autobiography. Well, Conan wrote the article in Pull Inquirer, and maybe it was something like that.
Maybe it was some interpretation. Okay.
You want to find one of those? There's a condensed version in here.
Okay. Was it longer online still?
No, it's just condensed of your life.
Condensed version.
Condensed version of your life.
Yeah, condensed.
Any other questions?
I bet you you'll draw better than you could possibly have imagined.
That I can draw?
When you start to draw again, you won't believe it. But you've had all this stuff in you all these years, and suddenly you'll be able to draw better than you ever could.
Oh, I know what you mean. I've had that happen before.
And then you'll have to take your old novel and you'll say, oh, and you'll have to sort of integrate, because all this time,
right,
you've been getting better without realizing. It's a weird thing. I've had the same thing happen.
Well, I've had that happen before, yeah, not for a period of 25 years, but yeah.
I have had that happen. I've
really?
Had it gone for periods of 17 years, and because I had anorexia, so I drew like mad, then I didn't draw at all, and I thought it was all gone, and then I came back a long, long time later, and it was like this thing had been, or my way of seeing had gotten more acute.
Well, I think we keep looking, not only at the world, but other people's art too,
yeah,
and learning,
yeah,
even though we are not conscious of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm expecting I'll be able to draw like Michelangelo.
Anybody else? Any other questions? No, Chester.
So, the new book, the new collection, uh-huh, is it from original art, or is it scanned from the old comics?
It's 98% from the original art.
Oh, wonderful.
A few pages that for one reason or another, I didn't have the originals. I couldn't find them. But we also worked very hard on the scans once they were done. As I worked hard on it, we went over each one and touched up anything that had been damaged or deteriorated in some way. But I kept all my originals because I've always had in mind that I was going to have a reprint. So now I'm going to sell them all off. Because now we have the digital scans of them, so now I can free up some space. Just charge thousands and thousands of dollars.
For somebody back there?
So the industry's changed a lot. So we don't need monthly books all the time. A lot of the best books out there right now published on a regular schedule.
Right.
They want to sell a book when it's ready, not just meet a schedule. So would you consider doing a monthly book?
No, because I can't meet deadlines and I don't want to meet deadlines.
But even if it was like quarter, once a year, like an annual?
I don't think so. It doesn't really appeal to me. Maybe at some point I might change my mind. Because the one thing I really liked about having a comic book, it was supposedly on a schedule, but I never, ever adhered to the schedule. I couldn't have even if I wanted to. But the one thing I liked about it was the relatively immediate feedback. You put out a comic book and then letters come in. And then you can print the letters and answer them in print. And I like that business of having my readers actually in communication with me. But other than that, I don't see any real reason to want to do that. The stories would have to be cut up into short segments. What they have to have as short stories. And sometimes I'm hurrying up too much. I guess what I did miss in this book is there's no color inside this book. And I had really experimented with color a lot in my covers for the Yellow Horse. Because I've worked in print, printing and publishing all my life. I worked as a pre-press technician and also as an art director for a number of years. So I'm very fascinated by printing processes and what you can achieve through printing processes. So I was playing with it just endlessly in the covers. And I would love to do more of that. But now that there's web comics and web publishing, I can put things out there in that way and probably get feedback pretty quickly. And coloring, of course, is not a problem.
Anybody else? No? One or two more? No? All right. Well, if you'd like to read more about Catherine, as somebody mentioned, you can read more about her in the current issue of Quill and Quire, which is available page and panel. Or if you come to the Doug Wright Awards tonight, you can get one for free.
Oh, it's available in the store, is that?
Yeah.
Well, that's the page and panel list.
Yes.
The store, yeah.
Catherine, thank you so much for
talking to us today. Thank you for being here.